Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of May 11th, 2022. Well, as you may, if you've been following along, you'll know that we are in this process of cross-posting a series of podcasts where I was the guest, fortunate to be the guest, on a podcast called Franklin Matters, which is a local podcast in the town that I live in. It's my host, Steve Sherlock, does a great job of covering local events. But he and I got into a discussion about the implementation of the Massachusetts Climate Roadmap. What are the issues? And in a sense, to look at this as an ongoing process. So there you go. This episode is the fourth in the series, and it was originally posted March 3rd, 2022. So I hope you enjoy. We become a energy capital in the way that we have been other things at other times in the state's history. I mean, this is really a great opportunity. So it's a good thing. And it ties back to our narrative about the roadmap, right? This is one aspect of implementing the 2030 clean energy goals. We need wind power. The state's taking action. It's a good thing.
Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show. This session of the radio show shares my conversation with Ted McIntyre, Franklin resident and climate activist. We recorded this via the Zoom conference bridge on Thursday, March 3rd, 2022. This is part four of our ongoing series, Helping Me Make Sense of Climate. We talk of the weather variations, the recent mass House legislation touting wind power, the Ukraine situation, and how it ties to climate, as well as other recent news articles. I appreciate Ted helping me make sense of climate, and we hope this helps with your understanding as well. If you have climate questions or Franklin-specific climate questions, send them in, and we'll try to answer them in a future session. A link in the show notes, or use my email if you choose. The recording runs about 38 minutes, so let's listen to my conversation with Ted McIntyre as he helps me make sense of climate. Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, WFPR.FM, anywhere on the internet, and in the local Franklin, Mass. Area dial at 102.9. Here and again for another Making Sense of Climate session with my resident expert and guide, Ted McIntyre. Ted, happy Thursday.
Steve, it's great to be here, hacking our way through the undergrowth of issues and opportunities, huh?
Pulling apart the weeds, kind of right. Trying to make some sense of it. I mean, weeds probably not the best terminology today because there's still snow on the ground, but we don't have to worry about weeds while there is snow on the ground,
that's right? That's right. Although I just saw a weather report that said it's going to be 60 degrees on March 5th on Sunday.
Yeah, and we've got a soccer game on Saturday. So I would have appreciated more the 60 degrees on Saturday than Sunday. Yeah. It'll be 40s instead of sub-zero. But
well, I tweeted out a thing that says 60 degrees in March is great as long as you don't say climate change. And once you start saying climate change, it gets a little creepy.
But I think to our continuing piece that we're helping to help me make sense of, what we're seeing is the extremes. Clearly, New England has always had the change. It goes back to even what Mark Twain, every stick around in 5 minutes, it's going to change. But the extremes going from what, 20 to 60 in a day? We didn't have that, I don't think. That gyration, there were changes, but not that significant.
Well, I think everyone has in their head the concept of the bell curve. Right, yeah. Just some sort of Gaussian distribution, if you want to be technical. But the bell curve is this kind of rounded thing. And it represents the random, let's just say, temperature on a given day, right? And it's very instructive because what you're saying is true, is that the bell curve is doing two things. One, the average, the middle of the bell with a the hammer or the clapper hangs, right, the middle of the bell, that is moving towards higher temperatures. So the whole distribution, the whole bell is shifting to hotter average temperatures. But at the same time, the bell is getting wider, right? So it's going from the nice sort of Liberty Bell shape to more of a dome where there's more and more extremes in that on any in the weather distribution. I mean, I hope that's a clear enough visual, but I mean, it is kind of a statistical lesson in statistics. And the other thing you see is that sometimes on the weather report, they'll say, oh, there are three times as many new high temperature records compared to cold temperature records, right? Sure. You say in any climate that's stable, there ought to be a new low temperature record set somewhere for each new high temperature record set. Mm-hmm. If you're consistently setting new high temperature records, that means something's going on, right? Things are changing. You're not oscillating around the average anymore. So
something is definitely going on. Yeah. I mean, weather is one of the issues, I think, that why we're making sense of climate. People, at least the climate deniers, have been able to get away with, well, you know, this is normal. This is what's happening. It's like, really?
Well, I think that it's a good place to start to talk about the weather, because the weather is important. The temperature is important. And of course, the phrase climate change, global warming suggests temperature, right? But the implications of those changing temperatures are extremely broad. They go to many, 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 many places that you wouldn't think of to begin with. And that's the concern, is that we need to become aware and conversant with all of the different ways that the subtle changes in the temperature show up or change what we think is sort of a normal condition. I mean, that's just an overview, that it's all connected. It's not just about higher temperatures in March.
No, it's not a single piece. There's a whole lot there, which is why we're having a conversation on a regular basis. And there's so many topics to talk about. So talking about temp, talking about wind, Rep Roy and the House are supposedly today discussing some legislation to address wind power and kind of help Massachusetts along that way.
Yeah, it was an op-ed in the Globe. Let's see, today is
Thursday.
Thursday the 3rd, right? So yeah. Jeff Roy, our beloved Jeff Roy, and the Speaker of the Massachusetts House, which is a powerful position, Rep. Mariano, had an editorial in the Globe basically touting the a new bill that would have more allow for more wind power. Again, so the state would require the utilities to buy more wind power, and actually the state would be having auctions to generate this wind power. And I think the reason you want to do this kind of thing is because we need the clean electricity, because we may lose the power line that comes through Maine. I don't know if you remember, a few shows ago, we talked about the fact that the Mainers don't want the hydropower from Canada to come to us through their town. So we need to generate the power here. Representative Mariano said that, yeah, I was surprised. The waters off Massachusetts have enough wind in them that we could, as a state, supply 1/7 of the nation's needed electricity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's mind blowing. That little tiny Massachusetts, right?
With Cape Cod,
we could have this. And so, what I think the legislature, Rep. Roy and the Speaker of the House are trying to do is to say, this is an industry that Massachusetts can capture, right? These are jobs. These are all good stuff. We become a energy capital in the way that have been other things at other times in the state's history. I mean, this is really a great opportunity. So it's a good thing. And it ties back to our narrative about the roadmap, right? This is one aspect of implementing the 2030 clean energy goals. We need wind power. The state's taking action. It's a good thing. I think that the action here for people listening is to support, to call up and support your senators, support Rep. Roy, that this is a good thing to do, and we need to do it and keep pushing ever harder, because we We need that wind power, and we want the jobs. They're all, the jobs are going to go somewhere else if we don't get them.
If we don't do that, yeah.
Right.
The thing that caught my eye in the article, and obviously I haven't read the legislation yet. I'm sure it might get tweaked before it goes from the House to the Senate. I'm sure we'll cover that as it moves. But the thing that caught my eye is something related to that in regards to there also as part of the legislation, increasing storage capacity so that whether it's wind or solar or however else we're generating electricity, it also increases the storage of that for distribution, which, I mean, what's not to like about that?
Well, so storage is one of these buzzwords, right, that you hear, and it's not always clear what it means, but the idea is that, as people say, the sun doesn't always shine and the wind does not always blow, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's the phrase in the energy world for renewables is called intermittency, right? There are times when the wind turbine is not turning, and that is all designed in. The people who build the wind turbines know that, fully accept it. But it allows the possibility that there may be moments when you need to get electricity from someplace. You need to store some electricity. And so the storage concept is to have a humongous industrial scale battery. Mm-hmm. And here a battery is used in a very general sense that it could be, it's just a way of storing energy. So your lithium hydride battery is storing energy, but you could, you know, pump water up to the top of the water tower and then reconvert it to energy. That's also a battery.
Mm-hmm.
The technology for storing the electricity is another enormous industry that is highly technical because a lot of it's battery stuff, chemistry stuff, right? And Massachusetts has so many smart people, so many universities. I mean, we should be the leader in developing the technologies that we can sell to the rest of the world. It is. I agree with you. The storage part is at least as important as the wind, the turbine generation. Right? These are all funny words that you begin to speak when you're talking about renewable energies, right? Who's generating the wind? Where are you going to store it? There's the interconnects. I mean, you saw down in Somerset, the old coal power plant in Somerset is being converted to a manufacturing place for wind turbine blades and for the cement basins that they drop into the ocean to build the wind turbines on, right? These are great jobs. Yeah. And it's a place where they're going to bring the electricity back on shore, right? If you're generating the electricity out off of Martha's Vineyard, you need a big cable underwater to bring it back on shore. Anyway, it's a good thing.
And oh, by the way, somebody's going to build that cable. It's going to be long, it's going to be waterproof. Somebody's going to install it. Somebody's going to have to maintain it. So that's where the work, that's where the jobs come from. And if somebody's going to do it, let it be somebody from Mass.
And a part of the roadmap, so we keep coming back to the roadmap, there are provisions in the roadmap for training of people to do these jobs, right? And the equity issues, there are people who have been denied good jobs through our society for various reasons. I mean, this is an opportunity to make some recompense and give everyone the sort of opportunity we all want to do these jobs that we all need done. I mean, it's a win-win thing for everyone.
So in terms of some other things coming up, I know there's a webinar and a tangential item in terms of Mass housing project or program. I forget exactly, the link will be in the show notes, but it's around the state effort to increase the housing around transit. And oh, by the way, yes, Franklin has two transit stations, Dean downtown and then Forge Park. Clearly the town's working on the Franklin for All concept, looking at the zoning for downtown, but this is the state level of that kind of guidance the state's going to give us, which I think tangentially, there's also a piece that you're looking at in regards to the stretch goals for the building code. So we'll cover that. But the housing piece is a public hearing, webinar, information session next week. There'll be a link in the show notes. People can sign up if they want to get into more of that side. But then recently, the stretch goals, which we had touted before, have actually come out. But there's some issues with that from your point of view.
Well, yeah. So the state organization called DOER. That's an acronym for Department of Energy Resources, DOER. They were tasked with generating the building codes for the state. Right? Mm-hmm. Of course, the building codes are what's the run over the rise of your stair, stairs, how many outlets are in your room, blah, blah, blah. Okay, these are building codes tell you how to build a house.
Yep.
The particular aspect is how energy efficient are the building codes going to be? Right. And what the famous roadmap that we keep talking about, that postulated three different kinds of building codes that cities in Massachusetts could use. One was called the baseline code, which at this point only 50 towns of the 350 towns in Massachusetts use. That's getting better energy-wise each year. There's something called the stretch code, which harkens back to the 2008 Green Communities Act. And the stretch at that time was to make a code that was a little bit more aggressive in terms of energy efficiency, right? So that's mm-hmm. being updated. But the new aspect is something called a net zero building code. And the net zero building code is again, it's a set of rules, but they're opt-in. So a community can choose to adopt this building code for this town if they want to. They don't have to, but there are towns that want to. And the thing about this, the intent of this code called the net zero building code is essentially to not have any natural gas hookups, that all of the homes should be fully electrified. Okay. And again, since this is an opt-in code, if no one's required to do it, it should be as noble and pristine as possible. And what DOER, Department of Energy Resources, has done is to essentially make this very aggressive stretch code to allow natural gas hookups in buildings. In other words, the rules for making your buildings would allow you to attach natural gas. And that's just like contrary to the whole concept. Yeah. And it comes, a specific example is the town of Brookline has passed a law that says new buildings cannot connect to the gas grid. New buildings must be fully electric with heat pumps. Again, another thing that we've talked about in the past. There's a lot of state law that intervenes there. We don't have to go too far down that path. But I mean, there are specific examples of towns that want to have this very aggressive building code. The DOER has not proposed a building code that is as aggressive enough. And that's my complaint about it. And there's an opportunity until March 9th to send a letter to the DOER saying, please make the most aggressive net zero opt-in building code as possible. Now, mm-hmm. we'll have the link in the show, but you can take action and let the state know that, again, I mean, the thing that makes my hair stand on end is that this is not a requirement. Right. This is for people who want to have an aggressive towns that want to have an aggressive code. So let them go at it. Let them do the most aggressive thing.
Yeah. And if I recall, and I don't remember the year specifically, but I believe Franklin signed into that stretch goals as part of the green community that they did a few years ago. So,
Right.
I'm sure
Franklin is already on the stretch code. Right. Yeah, we already agree with that. So we're fine. We would not have to opt in unless the town chose to. Should, but that's a whole other question, right?
Well, this is an opt-in. We want to opt in at the better one that includes the other stuff we want too, right?
Right.
Yeah. So we're good where we are now. And then if it improves the right way, then we can step up to the next one. Yeah. And then I think taking terms of current events. Certainly the Russian action in Ukraine, that gives us a rationale or a way into any number of touch points around both climate and cost in one's home too.
It's a remarkable example of the connectedness of the climate issue up and down from stuff we would be talking about here in Franklin to global issues. I mean, it's strangely enough, the whole thing that you're watching on CNN or MSNBC of, you know, people in Lviv, that's all, there are climate connections to that. Here, can I give you the story? I'll give you
the short story, yes.
The short story is that Putin in Russia, is generally regarded as Russia is a petro state.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very hardly anything that you buy comes from Russia except natural gas, right? And that something like 40% of the European Union's natural gas supply, with which they heat their home, their homes, 40% of that from Russia, right? And Ukraine, even now, is getting its gas from Russia, right? Because, and you can go into all sorts of underlying politics, but Putin has been able to grab hold of that industry, and the industry is him, the industry is the state, he is the state. I mean, it's all tied up, right?
Yeah, the oligarchy.
But there's money going to keeping Putin alive because Europe needs the gas, the methane, natural gas to heat its homes. Okay. And we can talk all you want about the yachts, the oligarchs' yachts, and take them. I mean, that's chicken feed compared to the idea that we're sending a huge amount of money to Putin to buy the natural gas. And you'll notice that even in the United States, President Biden has explicitly excluded natural gas from the sanctions. There's no sanctions on the natural gas, right?
Why? Because
it's a double-edged sword. If he shuts down if he tries to hurt Putin by shutting down the natural gas coming into Germany, then gasoline prices here in the United States will skyrocket. I mean, so but even that interdependency is telling, right? We are all stuck with this guy, and he has leverage over us because of this fossil fuel. Right. So I say, well, what can be done? If you look on TV, I mean, I look on occasionally, look on Fox TV, and they say, ah, we got to drill for more natural gas, right? We need more gas, American independence. We need more gas. Let's go. Over in Europe, they're going to bulk up their military defense spending, right? All that's going to take 2 years,
right?
So everything we're doing is saying, okay, you know, later on, we'll have some leverage against Mr. Putin. I think from a climate perspective, you can say the United States should reintroduce what was after World War II, the Marshall Plan. So for those of you, I'm not old enough to quite remember, but I read about it when I was a kid. The Marshall Plan was the United States giving foreign aid to Europe to rebuild after World War II, right? We just gave them a whole lot of stuff because we knew that if their market came back in 1950, we could sell them stuff, right? So we helped. The Marshall Plan was to help Europe.
Right.
You could do the same thing today by sending into Ukraine and into the European Union heat pumps, right? And these are things you and I have talked about in Framingham that we should need to have on this building code. A heat pump is a way to warm your house, heat your house, that just uses electricity, does not use any natural gas, right? Bill McKibben put up a post saying, you know, you could kickstart the industry in the United States of manufacturing heat pumps. You could give them away. I don't know. You can almost give them away for free in Ukraine. By this time next year, there will be a significantly less demand for natural gas in both Germany and Ukraine. And Putin's main weapon goes away.
Right.
And that it all happens on the same timeline as, you know, Joe Manchin talking about let's drill for more natural gas, right? It's going to take time. So in this way creates jobs in the United States. It blunts Putin's most potent leverage he has over us because we're scared, right? We cannot cut off the gas because we're going to suffer if that happens, right? But the way out, to cut the Gordian knot, what you do is help the European Union have less dependence on Putin's natural gas. And it seems to me, and I would just say, I mean, I think that the President Biden, who is so much better than any other recent president, gave a wonderful State of the Union, but he missed the opportunity to boldly connect climate change issues with national security issues. And say it's all one and the same thing, right? That we need to, you know, in the pragmatic program, this peaceful, nonviolent, makes jobs, all the good things, is to help these guys, you know, send them more insulation. So every house in Germany is fully insulated, right? Could be done. And it's a way of reframing the global issue in the light of climate change and the very things that we know here. So we're talking about building codes in Massachusetts that would call for heat pumps. Yeah, okay. Then we go to Germany. We save the world from war and from climate change by putting heat pumps in Germany. Everything's one, as they say.
Yes, it's all connected. And oh, by the way, then perhaps, and as we talked, I think before, it still would be sometime after 2040, but it would be a help to our overall earthly climate situation, because by taking all this methane, taking all this oil away, we're not contributing net carbon to the atmosphere, et cetera, and thereby the earth becomes a healthier place to live.
Right, right.
Never mind, aside from dodging bullets. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the petrostate, again, this is a buzzword, but states that depend for their existence, basically, on the sale of fossil fuels, they are a danger. And as the energy transition goes forward and more of the world does get off fossil fuels and methane, they become slightly more powerful in the short term, right? Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia, Russia has more sway, but in 50, 60 years, when everyone's got a heat pump in their house, who cares if Mr. Putin is sitting on, wants to invade somebody? He doesn't have the money to, right?
Mm-hmm. So. Right. Yeah.
I mean, we've all spent 2 years being experts in epidemiology, and in the last 2 weeks, we've all switched over to be experts in foreign affairs. Right? It's a wonderful world.
Stay tuned. There's more coming. Who knows what it's going to be? But
right.
Who knows? We'll have to.
Well, I mean, it just to say. I mean, since I'm on a bit of a roll, the other thing to keep an eye on is that the day before the State of the Union address, and more or less at the same time that Putin invaded Ukraine, the UN Climate Agency, which I won't even bother with the acronym for, released a very depressing report on the implications of climate change for the world, right? Mm-hmm. And that it got buried, right? Yeah. Because everyone was too busy watching the missiles go into Kiev. Right. Yep. And the risk of these, unless we take action to restrain these petro dictators like Putin, all of our attention is going to be on these crises, which is just going to keep continuing to happen. Mm-hmm. And so there you go.
Yeah. I saw that report come out, and that was one of the frustration, because it's IPCC and it's all over the page. It's all over the tweets. It's all over the headlines. I was trying to find out what IPCC actually stands for. Clearly, it's an acronym. It took me like 15 minutes of digging and following before I finally found.
Here's the story. The UN in 1989 held what was called a meeting in Rio de Janeiro.
Mm-hmm.
Right, where there was what's called the framework on climate change was signed by George H.W. Bush, right? So this is way, way back. Part of that Rio de Janeiro United Nations framework was to set up another organization called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC.
Yeah.
And the Rio de Janeiro framework said, the rule was that the IPCC would report every 5 years on the physics of climate change, the social implications of climate change, the various. So now we have this continuing release of reports on it that are very confusing. They're difficult to read. This latest one is, I think it's 3,000 pages long. I mean, who can read 3,000 pages of depressing news? But the take-home lesson, this IPCC report ends with a statement, at least I'm told, that we have a very short window basically to maintain a livable planet. You got one job, don't blow it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all subsumed in whether or not that 80 mile long convoy is going to get from Belarus to Kiev. I mean, that's what we're all looking at.
Right. Yeah. So at least the link on the IPCC sixth assessment report, which we'll include in the show notes, gives you a variety of resources. And 3,675 pages. If you really want the full thing, you want some reading material. There's a technical summary for those who are really technical, and I would not put myself there. there's a summary for policymakers. Now, I may read that one because I have to understand what policymakers a la a Rep. Roy and others are going to do. The frequently asked questions, at least the way they're touting it, is kind of the aims to help interpret its concepts and findings to a broader audience. So that would be the place I would start.
Right.
And then there's fact sheets and other stuff. So there, it's going to be a rich link. You can go there for a while, but the frequently asked questions, I think, is the key place I would point people to.
Yeah, the just so that people have confidence, this IPCC, what they do is they have volunteer scientists who are not getting paid, right? Mm-hmm. Like probably 1,000 scientists. And all that they do is to read other scientists' papers and digest other scientific reports and basically synthesize them, assess them, boil them all down into, say, what does it mean? And so I've heard it said that this IPCC process is like the most stringent scientific effort in the history of mankind. Mm-hmm. Right? It's got the most gravitas, and people roll their eyes, but it is the gold standard of what to think about climate change. And if anything, the scientists are too conservative because they want to make sure that everything is, you know, absolutely sound, they say.
Yeah, and tying it back to the things that we were hearing along with, you know, the COVID process and the testing and the peer review. And this effectively is after those articles and journals and studies have been posted and published, the summation of those is gathered by this group, and then they digest them and bubble it up. And it seems to be that, our estimates are off. We're going faster than we should be. And we need to, our timeline, I think, in terms of what your, the end line was, the window for taking action is shortened.
Right. Sobering, I think is the right word.
Sobering, probably. Yeah, depressing. Let's not go there, but sobering for sure. Let's use the wake-up call and use the action we have to do something about it.
Yeah. So there's a link to the Bill McKibben article is an easy read. He's a very good writer. Mm-hmm. He explains the idea of helping Europe transition to heat pumps and why it is a pragmatic thing to do. Not a golden bullet, but it's a pragmatic thing to do, and we darn well ought to be doing it sooner rather than later.
Yep. And then while we're in kind of that governmental realm, there was a couple of things on the government side. There's a suit, I think it's from West Virginia, against the EPA. And there was a Globe article that I had found that brought this to light, and coincidentally, there's a mass case that was settled in favor of the EPA back upon a day. And it's going to be dependent upon who the current Supreme Court, which way they're going to go in terms of reinterpreting the precedents, which should be there and could be taken, or are they going to deviate and do something on their own? I think that's the concern we have in regards to what the EPA is able to do in regards to legislation or it regulations.
We've all heard a lot of talk about how the shift in the Supreme Court, you know, is putting things like Roe v. Wade at risk and all these sort of rules, a fundamental shift. The question that's before the court is deeply profound and extends way beyond climate change. I believe it or not, but again, it shows the connections. The specific question at hand is that the EPA, in trying to address climate change, said that because Congress had told it to solve the problem. So at the Massachusetts versus EPA, the Supreme Court says, EPA, you have a responsibility to deal with climate change, right? Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court said, EPA, it's not that that they could deal with climate change. The Supreme Court said they must deal with, they have to do something. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the EPA comes back and says, right, the cheapest way to address climate change is to address carbon dioxide emissions at the state level. Mm-hmm. Right. And the hook there is that the EPA said, the EPA does not need to go into an individual power plant and say, go behind the fence in quotation marks and stop the chimney in the particular power plant. They said, you can keep burning if you do something else somewhere else in the state,
right?
To reduce carbon dioxide pollution. Well, the people in West Virginia said, nay, 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 you can't do that. Congress did not give you that explicit authority. Your regulations that you've written are too broad. The EPA must only has the ability to control carbon pollution behind the fence of the power plant, inside the property of the power plant, not at an economy level. Okay, fine. You can debate about that all you want.
Right.
But the implication of the whole thing is that if the Supreme Court agrees with West Virginia, essentially what it's saying is that the executive branch, the EPA, the president, cannot write regulations based on a broad command from Congress. So Congress said to the EPA, go take care of carbon pollution.
Yeah,
the EPA goes ahead and take. What the Supreme Court decision might do is to say that Congress has to tell the EPA, you will limit carbon dioxide in this particular way to this particular number,
be more specific.
And because of that, all other regulations become at risk. That is to say, health regulations, OSHA regulations, financial regulations, because all of those regulations are written based on a broad command from Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, we all remember in horror when Steve Bannon said that he wanted to end what he called the administrative state. Remember that in 2016?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, this ends the administrative state. This ends regulation because what it means is that Congress would have to write each and every OSHA restriction. Congress would have to pass a law that says you must wear a mask at work, right, for COVID. You know Congress is never going to do that. It basically puts everybody back in the 1870s, right, before there was any kind of federal regulation. And that's the risk of this particular Supreme Court case, which will be announced probably in June. And what's depressing about the whole thing is that the Supreme Court did not have to take this case, right?
It could have passed because there were prior precedents, as at least the article I referenced, certainly in the mask case is one of them. It's already been decided to a certain extent. So
in fact, there is no specific rule on the federal government books that they're talking about.
Right.
Because for various reasons, we don't need to go into this, but the Supreme Court wants to talk about it. So they took the case, which means they want to gut the EPA, which is horrifying. Right.
Yeah.
And so put your seatbelt on, because come June, there's going to be a real sea change. And again, it comes back to being, how mobilized are people? How much do people care about this issue? And what can we do about it? There are things that can be done. We'll find out when we get there, but it's something to be aware of that we as citizens need to become engaged about, because the Supreme Court's pretty important. When they say things, it lasts a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in the Democratic Republic, whatever terminology you want to term it, based upon our Constitution, there are three forms or three branches of the government that are effectively equal amongst equals. And this court case effectively would change some of that, to the extent that the administration, which then runs all the divisions, if you will, the EPA, all the different bodies that execute, that balance gets changed significantly.
I mean the idea that Congress would pass a law that says the EPA can regulate carbon dioxide at the statewide level, right? Mm-hmm. As in this plan, it's so specific that it would never happen. It's just too much politics, right?
Yeah.
And the same thing would go for every workplace regulation, every safety regulation, everything. It would just bog the government down. And that's, I think, what the Supreme Court wants is, less.
Some folks have gained access through that to try and undermine democracy.
But the question, what you do about that, that's a whole other podcast, right?
Yes, yeah.
That's a big topic.
That's out of our scope. We're just trying to make sense of climate. But as those who have listened, and we thank you for listening and, comment, share with us your concerns. But
you can't start talking about one thing without going somewhere else. And we're going to have to determine, you know, stay within our lane as much as possible. But oh, by the way, it's related to this. It's related to that.
It's related to everything.
So in our family tree, we must be related somewhere, right? Yes, we are. Absolutely. It all comes back to that. We are human living here on this sphere, traveling through light space, et cetera. So they say, well, I'm a little scared, but I've got a little bit more sense about what we're getting into, which is the whole point of this.
Absolutely. Don't be scared. Fear not, right? Fear not. There are things... There are things that can be done. Famous Joan Baez saying about action is the antidote to despair. Yes. Right? You hear stuff, you say, oh my God, well, okay. That's the time it's good to think about it. It makes you feel better. And so, and there's lots of ways to, people can take action. Send me a letter if you want I'll give you a few hundred.
Yes. Well, and back to what we were starting with, there are some things that clearly people can take an action on. They can follow the links in the show note for the hearings, for the webinars, et cetera, et cetera. And continue to join us on our journey as we make sense of climate. Well, thank you, Ted. This has been certainly fun on the one hand, but you know, we're living on the edge, but hey, you know, the edge is where it's at, right?
Well, it's a pleasure to be here and great chatting. And I think knowledge is power.
Power. That's a good way to close with it. Yes. And for those listening, we do this because Franklin matters. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008. And used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.
Very cool.